Welcome, everyone. We will go a little out of order today. Surprise, surprise. We will start by opening a work session on House Bill 2345. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2345 would eliminate the so-called one-bite rule in actions for damages caused by dog bites. There are dash three amendments for the committee to consider, which would apply the bill only to claims for economic damages. And so economic damages are usually defined as out-of-pocket losses, so it would be medical expenses plus lost wages, but would not include things like pain and suffering and the like.
Okay, and we have Representative Krieger with us today on this one. Is this the one you came for, Representative Krieger? I mean, is this the only one you came for? Okay, the one and only. Well, why don't you come on up here and maybe you could just give us your comments on what your original bill did before it was amended and on these amendments. You promised you wouldn't bring these pictures, Representative Krieger.
Oh.
I was already on board.
Oh, this poor child. Is this a child or a woman? I can't tell.
Well, let's have Representative Krieger.
Here, Bertie, for the record, picture. Wayne Krieger, State Representative from District 1.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess the pictures are the
Just a couple comments. I wasn't here
when the lady from,
I believe, Representative Roblin's district came in. She was concerned because she was had one of the dog rescue projects down there. And I was really surprised that anyone would try to operate that type of a business or an enterprise without having insurance, because insurance for that would be really not that expensive. And you and I have talked about the amendments. I believe since I was here the first time, we had that attack in Portland on the woman. And then this morning on TV showed the five-year-old boy being attacked by the pit bull and a half lab pit bull mix, taking two men to get him off this five-year-old child, received quite a bit of damage. That was on TV this morning. And I think the basis and the idea of holding dog owners accountable for the economic loss and the cost of medical treatment. In the case of the lady involved, whose pictures you've got there, as I said before, she's up over $70,000, has two operations to go. There could be instances where there's no insurance involved. If this was a child, regardless, you know, to what degree, where they may not have the funds to pay for these operations. Most of this is being paid for by these people themselves with some of their own insurance, but still they have a considerable amount of expense. And I think people need to be responsible for their dogs. You see nationwide a trend of more states starting to move to where we're going because of the number of attacks and the severity of those attacks.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing more more dogs trained to be aggressive and bred to be aggressive. And this will be a wake-up call for people to make sure they understand that it's their responsibility to keep their dogs on a leash or inside, or if there's any question about the dog's temperament.
Okay.
So thank you for coming. Are there questions of the committee for for Representative Krieger?
Where was this woman attacked, Representative?
Where was she attacked?
Yeah, where does she live?
She lives by Green Acres in my district, just south of Representative Roblin's district.
Okay.
Coos County.
What kind of a dog was she attacked by?
One of the big ones. What's the big one they call?
Rottweiler.
Rottweiler. I believe that's what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just happens to be the same breed of dog that almost wiped me out when I was on a bike ride through Yamhill County. This dog was coming
coming fast.
I bet you were pedaling fast.
I was pedaling fast. What really shocked me is I was with my daughter, and I just took off, and then I thought, oh, where's my daughter?
Uh-oh. First Amendment free speech.
She was pedaling faster than I was, and she's a heck of a lot younger, so we made it out of that one, but it was a pretty frightening circumstance. Any other questions for Representative Krieger? Just for the committee, these amendments, it's kind of like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Representative Krieger's original bill covered, as I understand it, only medical expenses, and it was broadened in House Judiciary to cover economic and non-economic damages. And this amendment would strike a balance down the middle. It would cover more than just medical expenses. But it would cover full economic damages. For example, this woman here, I'm sure she probably missed work as she had a job, and it would cover that kind of actual out-of-pocket damages. So any more questions? Okay. We're in work session, and we have a dash three amendment. Senator Byer, do you like this amendment?
Madam Chair, question. I don't think it does, but I'm looking at 31710, and it says the section does not apply to punitive damages, so I assume that means this does not apply to punitive damages.
That's correct. The bill, well, go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Senator Byer. Yes, there was some concern over at the House side about whether this was going to change the requirements for punitive, so they expressly put in sub 3, which states the section does not affect the requirements for award of punitive damages. Now that if you adopt the dash threes, that language comes a little bit superfluous because it would expressly only apply to economic damages anyway. So, but to answer your question, yes, you would have to prove foreseeability and the other requirements that you normally have to prove in a punitive case, in a dog bite case.
Senator Byer has moved the dash three amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Byer.
Pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2345 as amended by the dash 3 amendments to the Senate. Excuse me. He has moved 2345A as amended by the dash A 3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Okay. I will carry that bill. Thank you, Representative Krieger. Okay. Next. Somebody, people on the phone.
Maybe somebody who wants to testify for the rate sex intimidation.
You know what we should do? We should stop in the line on the 086 and tell people. Okay, we're going to now open a public hearing on two bills, House Bill 3086 and House Bill 2908. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2908 requires insurance companies to pay insureds up to the limit of their policy when the insured sustains an injury from an accident with an underinsured or uninsured car, even if the car was owned or operated by a public body or employee who was subject to the Tort Claims Act. This bill arises out of the interaction of the uninsured motorist provisions in the Oregon Insurance Code with the Oregon Tort Claims Act, ORS 742.504, requires insurers to provide uninsured motorist coverage to their insureds and to provide, quote, all sums that the insured is legally entitled to recover as general and special damages from the owner or operator of an uninsured vehicle because of bodily injury sustained by the insured. However, ORS 30.270, which is part of the Tort Claims Act, limits the liability of public bodies and employees to $200,000, notwithstanding the actual amount of damages that the party may have suffered. So what 2908 would do is require damages to be paid in the full amount of the policy, not limited by the Tort Claims Act. 3086 establishes that a motor vehicle liability policy must contain a provision that provides liability coverage for each family member of the insured who resides in the same household as the insured, in an amount equal to that purchased by the insured. 3086 also contains a provision that is similar to what is found in 2908. It establishes that an insurer must pay uninsured or underinsured coverage up to the limits of the policy, irrespective of the liability limits in the Tort Claims Act.
Okay. We have people on the phone here, and we also have people who are not on the phone. Maybe we should take some non-phone people. Who should we take first? The main guy, Jim Circus? Or should we take Neil Jackson?
Either one of them is fine. I think Jim Circus is a victim. Okay, this is a lawyer. So, local shipping is a victim. So.
Okay, let's start out with Neil Jackson and Tasha Mowry. And Ada Valenti. I think they're all three on the same panel?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, you all are signed up
for the comprehensive bill, which is 3086.
Right.
Okay. So go ahead, introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Neil Jackson. I am here on behalf of the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And I would add, Madam Chair, I am also signed up for 2908, the government. If you'd like me to wait, that's fine. Otherwise, I can address that also.
Actually, if you talk to the provisions, unless you have some objection to how the subject matter of 2908 is handled in 3086, if you just address both of the components of 3086, that would be probably the best, most efficient.
Very good. Do you want the other witnesses to introduce themselves first or when they begin?
Why don't you go ahead and then we'll take them as they...
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the purpose of House Bill 3086 is to address a long-standing, we believe, inequity in the insurance policies that you purchase.
Did you identify yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
The policy, you cannot buy a policy in this state that will protect your family members if you are driving the car and there's a very serious accident and your spouse, your kids, your grandkids, if they live with you, if they get horribly injured, even though you may have a $100,000 liability policy, you will find out that there is only $25,000 coverage for your family members. And that's the family member exclusion that this first part of 3086 addresses. And it presents some interesting anomalies. I can give you an example that Representative Bonamici brought up when she debated this bill on the House floor. If you decide that you want to go pick up your 22-year-old son from college after graduation, and your 22-year-old son is bringing a couple of his friends from college, and it's a long trip, and you pick them up and you're driving home, if you're driving the car and for some reason you make a mistake and you take out a tree, if your son is horribly injured, your son will be limited to $25,000 recovery even though you have paid for a $100,000 policy. The converse is not the same. If one of your son's friends is allowed to drive your car, your policy still applies. But because the friend driving is not a family member, both you and your son can make a claim for up to the $100,000 policy limits that you paid for. Now, if you switch off driving, if your son is driving, you and your son are limited to 25. If a friend drives, your coverage goes up to 100. And the problem this presents is when you purchase your policies, you take a look at the first page, what's called the declaration sheet, and you look at your coverages, and you will see PIP coverage, which pays your medical bills, liability coverage, and you tell your agent, I want $100,000 liability coverage to protect myself and my family, both in case we hurt somebody horribly or if one of my family members get purchased. What's not in there, unless you go into the policy, and the one I like to use is the Metropolitan Policy on page 4, at the bottom of the page, it says we do not cover the insured's relative living in the same household as the insured. What that says is there is no coverage for the person who bought the policy or any of their family members. The courts have interpreted that to mean because we have minimum coverage that is required, all that has to be covered is the $25,000, even though you paid for $100,000. And so the purpose of this portion of the bill is that people will get what they think they're buying. Because I challenge any of you to look at your policies, and I also challenge you to call up your agent and ask them, if I'm driving, I make a mistake, and my wife or husband or kids are in the car, how much coverage can they obtain from this policy? And I would be willing to bet you that half or more of the agents will say, well, your limits, your 100,000 limits. And that is simply not the case. You can't buy that coverage in this state. The commissioner's office researched it, and they advised us there was only one company that sells policies that will give your family members the coverage that you think you have. Then we went to that company. Oh, we don't sell that to Oregonians. So nobody in the state can buy a policy even though they think they've got that coverage. I'll address briefly the second section of 3086 and 28908. That is the government exclusion. Mr. Surface will be calling today. His wife was injured by a government vehicle. I believe it was the Beaverton School District. She suffered a very serious head injury. We've introduced her written testimony that she gave before the House Consumer Protection Committee, but I can tell you she got through two sentences before she locked up. She really has a serious brain injury. They thought they had purchased $1 million umbrella policy, and they just assumed, all right, there's $200,000 available from the school district, which is the tort claim limit, and we can then go to our own underinsured policy and obtain the rest of the funds she was entitled to. The Court of Appeals said that there's an anomaly in the statute, that because the statute says that the government is limited to the $200,000 tort claim limit, that means that's all you can legally obtain. Therefore, you can't make a claim on your own policy for $1 million coverage, even though that's what you've been paying for years. And that is addressed in the second part of 3086 and in 2908. All it does is simply says whether or not you get hit by a government vehicle or a private vehicle, you can still make a claim against your own policy if you have an umbrella policy with sufficient coverage. And
thank you.
I'll answer any questions or the other witnesses can proceed.
Why don't we take the panel? And we have written testimony here, so if you could keep your comments as short as possible and not read the whole statement, that would be very much appreciated. We're reaching the end of our deadlines here, and so we have to be very conscious of time.
My name is Ada Volante, and March of 2004, we were taking my husband and I and my grandson and my my two grandsons and my son and a friend of my grandson's on a trip to Disneyland. And during the late nights of our trip, the car went out of control and tipped over, went into a field, rolled several times, went into a field. My grandson's friend was killed in the accident.
That's okay. Take your time.
Anyway, we thought we had purchased a $300,000 liability. Now, in 2005, I discover that I only have $25,000 coming to myself and my grandchildren. I know the deceased child's parents get $100,000, but we were told that that's all we would get was $25,000. Now, the bills alone, that $300,000 that we thought we had would have covered everything and everybody else that was in that accident, but that was not the case. We only got the $25,000, my grandson and myself.
But were you driving?
No, my husband was driving the car, ma'am.
Okay, and so because you were a family member...
Right, it was under the family provision, mm-hmm. Yes.
And was your husband injured too?
Yes, he was. He had his vertebrae smashed.
So, but he got more than $25,000.
He got nothing, ma'am.
Got nothing?
No, mm-mm, because he was driving the car.
Okay, all right. Thank you for your story. Do you have questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Tasha Mowry, and I'm 23 years old. And back in September 2005, me and my boyfriend had moved to Bend. And when I moved there, I called around for insurance policies, and Farmers offered me a relatively low price, and they said for it was either $12 or $13 more a month I could have the $100,000 policy instead of the $25,000 policy. So I bought that, and then on October 2nd of 2005, me and my boyfriend were driving back. He was driving from Portland to Bend, and he lost control, and my side hit the driver's side of the oncoming vehicle, and I woke up about a week and a half later at home with no memory. I'd had a closed head injury. I had a broken foot. I had to have pins put in my foot. I had a broken collarbone. I had bruises all over the place and no memory. And worst of all, I'd lost my baby that I was 7 months pregnant with. She died as a result of the accident. And I had to have speech therapy afterwards, physical therapy afterwards, and my bills are more than $45,000 right now, and that's with the hospital writing off some of those bills. And I found out shortly after my accident they only offered me $25,000. And at first I thought it was because they messed up. I'm like, I told my boyfriend, no, I bought the $100,000 policy, and then I learned it was because of this law that I was only going to be offered the $25,000. But the guy that we got in the accident with, he claimed against our insurance policy. He got the $100,000, which was well-deserved. He was hurt, too, but they only want to offer
me. So it's
me.
Because you and your boyfriend were in the same household?
Was yeah, because we lived concept? Together.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you, sir, Mr. Jackson, is the requirement that they be a family member, or they be in the same household, or both?
In Ms. Mowry's case, it was because it was her policy that applied, because her boyfriend was the driver, and as a permissive user, he became the insured. And she is also the insured, and the way the law is written right now, insureds can be excluded from anything beyond $25,000. So it was because it was her policy, she was the insured, she doesn't get the $100 that she thought she bought. It says the insured, blood relatives, family members living in the same household. She was the insured, therefore the exclusion applied to her.
But had she been driving, would she have gotten the full $100,000?
No, she would not. And the reason for that would be in this situation. If the accident is your fault, then you cannot make a liability claim on your own policy. And that's fine. I mean, that makes sense. It's to insure the liability under this section of the policy. If it's your fault, whether you're the insured or not, or a permissive user, you can't make a claim against your own policy for anything other than PIP. In her case, even though she was a passenger, it was her policy on her car, and therefore she was subject to the $25,000 limitation. This bill would address that and say that if the insured is not at fault, they can make a claim on their own policy under the liability provisions.
And you were not judged to be at fault on this one?
Me, no.
I mean, your boyfriend, was he judged?
He was.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you all for coming in and telling your stories. Should we get Jim Surface on the telephone?
Okay. Yeah, Representative Gerard here.
Oh, Representative Gerard, I'm so sorry. Are you here on these bills?
No, this one, please.
Okay, please come up. I do apologize. You were hiding behind the audience there. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. My name is Representative Fred Gerard. I represent District 17. I'm one of the sisters of Senator Byers. I kind of live out in the Tule Weeds. The San Juan Valley is the San Juan watershed is primarily my district. This bill came before us in consumer protection. And to make a long story short, I got a couple handouts for you.
That would be three.
That'd be three handouts. Yeah, thank you. That's why I'm a representative and not a senator.
We're very precise on Senate judiciary here.
We sat through quite a long hearings with these, and they're very touching. And I fully believe that there is a problem that needs to be addressed. And that is, a lot of people think that they have coverage when they do not. The problem with the bill as it is drafted now is it allows both non-economic and economic recovery. And if you turn to the file that says it's a picture of, with John Powell, the second page gives you a definition of what's non-economic and what's economic. And I think that that is extremely important. Economic damages mean verifiable monetary losses, including but not limited to reasonable charges necessarily incurred for medical, hospital, nursing, rehabilitative services, and other health care services, burial memorial expenses, loss of income, and past future impairment of earning capacity, reasonable and necessary expenses incurred for substitute domestic services, recurring loss of an estate, damage to the reputation that is economically verifiable, reasonable and necessarily incurred costs due to the loss of property, and reasonable costs incurred for repair or for replacement of damage, whichever is less. Sorry, I probably shouldn't read these, but I need to. Non-economic damages mean non-monetary losses, including but not limited to pain, mental suffering, emotional distress, humiliation, injury to reputation, loss of care, comfort, companionship, and society, loss of consortium, inconvenience and interference with normal and unusual activities apart from gainful employment. I draw the line here in that if you're in an automobile accident and you are, say, the spouse that is driving and are responsible, I think that your health care insurance the injuries that were created need to be covered. All those losses that are deemed to be economic damages need to be addressed through the insurance policy. The problem that I had is the way that it passed out of our committee was that non-economic damages were included as well. So pain and suffering was thrown onto this. Now please picture this. Two people at a bar drinking profusely. One gets in the car, both of them get into the car, one husband and wife. The husband crashes into a pole. The wife sustains injury. She sues for not just medical injuries, but for pain and suffering as well. And you have a $3 million umbrella. It has all kinds of fraught with problems. And so I want you to look very closely at this bill. There's three options. You have the option to refuse at all, which would go back to PIP, which is a $25,000 maximum coverage. I really honestly don't support that. It could go to just economic damages, which I support, and I think that that's reasonable. Or you can include non-economic damages as well, which I think is an overkill and allows for all kinds of collusion and all kinds of problems that are going to be legal. It would be perfectly legal in that scenario for the wife of a drunk driver to sue and get pain and suffering. And so I'd ask that you look at this and look at those definitions and then please modify this bill before it's finalized.
But wouldn't you agree that right now if the person riding the passenger seat was not the guy's wife but, say, his hunting buddy, he would still be able to sue for the full umbrella coverage? How do you square that?
Well, but there would not be a collusion between him and the driver. So the thing is, what I'm saying is the drunk driver could prosper from this claim being a family member. So you have a drunk driver and his wife. The wife sues, gets a big claim. They go retire in Tahiti. So and the guy's not going to go with his buddy to Tahiti. So I see a world of difference in those two claims.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazansky.
I guess 2 points. One, I'm wondering if this, since this was on the House side, if there was any testimony, Representative, regarding your concern as to that actually playing out in other states, and two, what are other states doing besides the model that we currently have?
Actually, my understanding is most of the model, there's, actually, John Powell could testify to this better than I can as far as the models in other states. The testimony, there was a lot of testimony given before our committee. I think the vote was 5-2, and there was a minority report filed, and the minority report went on down. It was a partisan vote, straight partisan vote.
What did the minority report do?
The minority report took out non-economic damages.
So the minority report was basically the Dash 1 amendment?
Yes. Now, I'm not 100%, you know, if you want to modify the Dash 1 amendment, that's fine. But to me, that's a starting point. I just don't want it so a drunk driver can prosper from his claim being a family member. It's going to be fraught with collusion. If you find out that that you have a $3 million umbrella, but the other person only has a $1 million umbrella, and you can sue for non-economic damages, then you might all of a sudden decide that you are the at-fault driver. What it's going to do is it's going to raise insurance rates dramatically, and the people that are going to prosper is going to be a very narrow band of people that are going to prosper from it, and the ratepayers are going to pay quite a bit.
It's hard for me to imagine somebody risking their life in a drunk driving accident.
I'm not saying that they're going to intentionally crash the car. I'm just saying that if he does crash the car, he should not be, as a family member, able to prosper from the claim.
Hmm. Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. Sorry, I overlooked you there. Steve Morrell and John Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. With me is Steve Morrell, claims attorney with State Farm Insurance. Madam Chair, I think what I will do is let Steve proceed with more of a basic backgrounder on what coverage we're talking about and what the history of that coverage is for the committee's benefit.
Okay, welcome.
Chair Berg, members of the committee, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney with State Farm Insurance Company. I give advice to their claim department. There's two bills before you, both of them dealing with motor vehicle insurance, and all the components of the motor vehicle insurance deal with fault-based coverage. The first one that I'd like to talk to is 3086, is the bill that we both eliminate what we call the family member step-down clause in a policy, and would also make a government car have the potential of being an underinsured car. The other bill deals solely with the government prong of the equation. Some background on this whole issue is that prior to about 10 or 15 years ago in Oregon, there was family immunity. So in other words, in these situations where you have husband and wives getting in wrecks, they were immune between each other. There was no tort claim. That was the common law. It didn't exist that there was a tort claim. There was a case called Wynn versus Gilroy, and throughout Oregon history, I think the court struggled with this idea that of family immunity, and that it was an extreme case where a father was drunk, got an accident, and injured his children. And that was the case that the court said, okay, we're going to eliminate family member immunity. Insurance companies up to that time, consistent with family member immunity, had total exclusions from the liability coverage, which is a fault-based coverage. You only recover in the liability coverage if the person driving the car is at fault. So you collect from them. We had an exclusion that was total that was consistent with that family member exclusion. Part of the reason for that public policy and law is basically to promote family unity, to not have fraudulent claims from family members, and that whole set of issues that you get into when you open up the family immunity. In cases like we heard today, where you have objective injuries and they're severe injuries, that kind of breaks down. It's not, you wouldn't have fraud or you wouldn't have collusion. In the cases where you have minor injuries and sprains, when you have family members, the potential that you normally deal with fraud is exacerbated and build up claims, or claims that are either exaggerated or claims that are outright fraudulent. So we have kept the family member exclusion. Some years ago, probably in 1991 or so, Collins versus Farmers said when we had that exclusion, we had to at least provide the financial responsibility minimum coverage for liability to family members. That's $25,000 per person, $50,000 per accident. That's the history of this clause. So now when you buy a policy, instead of having a total exclusion, it says we exclude any coverage that's above the minimum amount for financial responsibility, states it in all caps, bold printed, what that amount is and who it applies to. And so we've limited our exposure by saying, okay, the claims will be just $25,000. When this issue came up in the House, with severe injuries in cases you have like this, that people have hard medical specials that need to be paid. We offered the middle ground of saying, okay, let's go ahead and keep the current family member step down, but if your economic loss exceeds that $25,000, then you'll be allowed to go up to the policy limit for economic loss. Feeling that was the middle ground. That's the ground we'd like to urge you to adopt on 3086 with the portion that deals with financial responsibility.
What is the cap for economic damages in a typical liability policy? Is there a distinction between economic and non-economic?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, no, there's not a distinction in a typical policy. Basically, we have policy limits that would limit both economic and non-economic to a non-family member. A typical State Farm policyholder might have $100,000 per person, $300,000 per accident. Mm-hmm. We do sell some higher limits than that, but not a whole lot. I'd say a great proportion of our book has that. Other people may just carry lower limits. You have to carry at least $25,000 per accident, $25,000 per person, $50,000 per accident in the state of Oregon.
Well, what would stop you from just having the insurance of family members an option that people could pay a little extra for?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, there wouldn't be anything that would stop us. We've just never felt like it was a good public policy to go down. And so we've stayed with just limited to the $25,500.
Do any states offer that as an option?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm not aware of any states that do. I know that Senator Przanski had a question of where the other states were on this. I don't have a division in numbers to be able to give you. I can tell you I'm aware of at least two states that still have family immunity, which is California and Indiana, and I think there are others out there that still say it's zero. I've been told by different people in our company that the step-down provision that Oregon has is not an uncommon provision across the United States.
Okay. Questions from the committee? No questions?
I've got comments, but no questions.
Okay.
But if I could speak to the government car portion of it, there's
the
other bill and the second half of this bill.
Oh, before you do that, if you, if we're going to do both things, we might as well do them in both in one bill. So if you have any comments on whether House Bill 2908 deserves different comments than 3086, they did come from different committees on the House side.
Chair Bergman, and just to speak that I've not really looked at the substance of these bills because just as a policy issue on the government car, we've not been in agreement with the proponents on this issue. Uninsured motorist coverage is a coverage that's mandated in Oregon. You buy it to protect yourself against people who are uninsured. So people who have no insurance, don't have self-insurance, get in an accident with you, your own uninsured motorist coverage takes the place of what would have been their liability, and on a fault basis on a motor vehicle policy goes ahead and pays for your damages. In addition to that, there's an add-on that's called underinsured motorist that you can buy. So that if I were to carry just the minimum limits and get in an accident with somebody, they would just have $25,000 that they could collect from me. But their injuries may be more than that. They have the ability to protect themselves from that situation by buying underinsured motorist coverage, which means they have limits higher than my limits. And what happens is my company will pay up to my limits of coverage, and where we stop paying and where maybe I've got personal funds and I contribute, you offset all of that from the limit of the underinsured motorist coverage, and you've bought, let's say, $100,000 of underinsured motorist coverage, you have to up to that amount of money to protect you. At the beginning of the uninsured motorist statute and continuing through the underinsured motorist statute when it was enacted in the state, it says in there that a government car is not an uninsured car, meaning it's also not an underinsured car. The reason for that is the government is an entity that has plenty of money that can pay for claims. They may not have insurance. They may self-insure all their claims, so there is no problem with them being able to do it. What we have here in Oregon, though, is the tort claim limit. The legislature has enacted a tort claim limit allowing for limited recovery. So people are only able to get $200,000. Our feeling on that's not what underinsured motorists is for, it's to take care of government cars. Government cars need to take care of their own liability, and you need to decide, okay, we like the policy of the tort claim limit, but we don't like the policy of the tort claim limit. But to graft a recovery after the state has paid out their limits of coverage onto a motor vehicle liability policy end runs that policy debate And it's probably not a good social policy because you don't have the concept, if I call it, you broke it, you fix it. You have somebody other than the party who's responsible for my company stepping in and paying for that. I've had conversations with the trial lawyers the last 3 or 4 years and encouraged them to go that direction. I think they just feel like they can beat up on insurance companies easier than they can beat up on the state, and that is what has brought forth this bill. There are some real serious injuries. I don't want to minimize what's happened to people, but I don't think private insurance is a solution. I think it's what the government's liability is that should be looked at.
Well, but how can you say that tort cap of $200,000 that has not been revised upward for at least 20 years, how can you call that fully insured?
Chair Burdick, I can't call it fully insured. I'm just saying that what happens is the tort cap should be revised. And that is an extraordinarily small amount of money, especially given the exposures the state engages in.
Well, but on the other hand, you could say the same thing for an underinsured driver. You could say it was their responsibility. What's the difference?
Chair Burdick, the legislature has decided that they'll burden people with $25,000 worth of coverage, $50,000 per accident. And I think what you have to look at is what can a private individual afford. And that level of coverage will cover most of the exposures they get into. If you look at what our average paid claim is for property and for bodily injury, a person is doing a good job by doing minimum limits. People who have more to protect or engage in higher exposures will have higher limits.
But I would assume that would be the same for the government, too. Not every claim goes up to $200,000. We're only talking about those extraordinary claims, where if a private person is doing it, underinsured motorist coverage would cover it. But if it's a government entity, you know, if you're the guy who gets in the accident, I don't think it makes much difference to you.
Chair Burdick, I think what I have told people, because basically Oregonians, if you decide to do this, Oregonians pay for it one way or another. They'll either pay for expanded coverage to my company through premiums, and we'll have to make a profit at doing it, and Oregonians will pay for it. Or else you'll raise the Tort Claim Act, and Oregonians will pay for it just through a different mechanism. From a social policy standpoint, I think the person that actually caused the harm paying for the damage is a better social policy.
Well, but, I mean, how could you say that, I presume most accidents don't involve, most claims don't involve government vehicles just by sheer numbers.
Chair Burdick, that's correct.
So how can you say that insurance rates would go up that much?
Chair Burdick, we've never really said insurance rates are going to go that much on the government car end of things. Our whole concern on that is, we don't pay for those claims today, so anecdotally, I'm assuming we would have some sort of impact on premium. I don't know what it is. I don't think it would be an extraordinary amount. We just don't believe it's a good social policy to go down. And the cost of insurance is not really the issue on the government car end of things that we've been talking about. We're talking about, you know, Oregonians will pay for it through some way. We think it makes more sense for the person causing the harm to pay for the loss.
Well, but if you're sitting there buying an umbrella policy of $1 million, isn't your expectation going to be that if for whatever reason something doesn't match that coverage, that your umbrella policy, I happen to hold one of these policies and I'm thinking very carefully right now, because if they don't work, why buy one in the first place?
Well, Chair Burdick, they work for people outside of your family and the government. They don't cover everything. And I'm probably the wrong person to ask what my expectations are, because I'm the person who has to tell people, okay, what we do cover and what we don't cover when we're talking the claims operation.
Madam Chair, could I ask that? John Powell again with State Farm Insurance Companies. I buy a liability policy not to protect my own body from damages when someone else injures me. I buy that liability policy and high limits to cover my liability should I injure someone else. If you go into business and have a small pizza store with delivery, no one steps up and covers your liability above your insurance cap. Whatever your limits, say you buy a $300,000 liability policy, you injure somebody and it's determined to be worth $500,000. Your insurance pays $300,000 of that. You would be asked to pay $200,000 out of your own personal assets. So that's why you'd buy a liability or an umbrella policy in that case, not to protect yourself in a situation like this. What this bill does A government car injures you, runs a red light, injures you severely. The government caps their liability at $200,000. Now you have to claim against your own insurance policy as not the wrongdoer. And what Mr. Murrell is explaining is the theory, as in Washington State, which does not have a cap, is the person who causes the harm pays. And the policy that this bill presents is a hybrid policy. They'll pay some, but not necessarily all. And that extra will be shifted onto insurance ratepayers. And as Mr. Murrell stated, we're not saying this would have a dramatic increase in premiums. It's really the philosophy of the wrongdoer paying. And government, in this case, has this arbitrary limit.
But if the person running over was the underinsured driver who only had, you know, $25,000 in liability coverage, then you'd have no problem with your uninsured motorist coverage.
Madam Chair, in that case, that person would get nothing except the $200,000. They could be injured just as bad as the people you've heard from and will hear from. Unless they have high limits.
Unless who has high limits?
Unless the person injured has high uninsured limits, mm-hmm. they'll collect nothing. If they have minimum limits, they'll collect nothing. They have to have more insurance than the person that hit them at $200,000.
Well, as I understand it, this bill would only affect people who have underinsured limits that are higher than the $200,000.
Madam Chair, that's correct, and that's why this is only a partial solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. People with low limits that get injured by government vehicles will still be out anything over that $200,000 limit. And that's why the only real solution to this problem is to raise the liability cap.
Well, you came to the right committee to say that.
Madam Chair, I'm just so glad to hear all these people coming in saying we need to raise the liability. I think we need to just run that darn bill and be done with
it. Yeah, maybe we could revive Senate Bill 280. Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay. Are you these people? We got another victim. Oh, let's call the lawyer. We're going to take one witness by telephone. We have several people signed up by phone, but because of time, we're just going to take one of these witnesses.
Do I have to dial something to dial out?
Nine.
One.
County Anderson's office. This is Kathy.
Hi, this is Matt from the Judiciary Committee. Is Mr. Anderson available to testify?
One moment, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, this is Jenny Burdick. I'm chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we have our committee members here. And we have a hearing going on House Bill 2908, which you signed up for, and wanted to get some brief testimony from you.
Thank you very much. I represented a woman named Opal Shipman, who is in her 70s, and she was run over by a Klamath Transit bus, amputating one leg and severely injuring the other. She had an uninsured motorist policy of $500,000. The adjuster for the transit district admitted that given the nature and severity of her injuries, it was probably worth somewhere in the ballpark of $700,000 to $800,000. The transit district paid its liability limit of $200,000. And we then made a claim upon Allstate Insurance Company, Ms. Shipman's own carrier, for the difference between the $200,000 recovered from the transit district and the $500,000 limit of her own policy. Allstate responded by saying that because of the surface decision, they did not owe anything above the $200,000 recovered from the government. This represented a pure windfall to Allstate Insurance Company, because if Ms. Shipman had been injured by anyone other than a government entity, she would have been entitled to the policy that she thought she had. There was nothing in the declarations page of her policy that carved out an exception for a government vehicle. There was no way she could have known that she would not have the coverage that for years she had paid for. The damage to her and the taxpayers are that her monthly living expenses went from $400 a month to $2,400 a month. She has to live in an assisted care facility now. That $2,400 a month will consume the net amount of her settlement in a total of about 5 years from the date of the injury. The injury happened 3 years ago, which means in about two, possibly 2.5 years, she will run out of money and then will become a burden to the taxpayers. In addition, the Medicare paid $38,000 of her medical bills. That wasn't all of her medical bills, but that's how much they paid. Because of the limited amount of coverage available, the $200,000, Medicare waived reimbursement of $38,000. Medicare would not have had to waive that reimbursement if Ms. Shipman had been allowed to recover the policy limits that she had paid for. And so, in essence, the insurance company has had a windfall of $300,000. The taxpayers have had to give up $38,000 in medical expenses that would have been recoverable from Medicare. And in addition, in another 2 years, she will become a burden to the taxpayers and will not very likely have the same quality of care that she has now. I would just emphasize that the normal consumer, upon purchasing insurance, has no idea of this steel trap that exists on the footpath of the insurance trail. And she is available and would testify that her funds are limited and she feels the injustice of what has happened to her. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Pazansky, this is...
Mr. Surface?
Yeah. No, this is Mr. Anderson.
Okay.
Who represented a client that he was describing. We were just joined a little bit late by Senator Pazansky. Are there questions from the committee?
Well, Madam Chair, I would just thank Mr. Anderson, because it's the same issue that we have with OHSU when people check into OHSU for services, they don't know that they're covered by the Tort Claim Act and won't be able to sue beyond this paltry $200,000 either. So it's nice to know that there are other ways that this impacts people, so we can get a broader discussion and maybe get this Tort Claim Act cap raised or eliminated altogether. Would you agree, Mr. Anderson?
I'm sorry, was there a question directed to me?
There was.
It was a roundabout question from a statement that I just made. Wouldn't you agree? You know, this same thing happens with OHSU, with people going to OHSU for treatment, and if they're injured, they only are allowed to sue for up to $200,000. So I was just indicating that it's nice to know there are other situations that this occurs as well, so that we can get even broader ownership in this discussion about the need to raise these caps. Wouldn't you agree?
I'm really sorry. I can hear your voice, but I can't distinguish.
Okay, here's the question. The question is, do you agree that the caps ought to be greatly increased or eliminated?
Yes, I do.
There you go. I couldn't have
okay.
asked
you're
the question
on the record.
Or got it the answer better myself.
Okay.
Here's the thing I worry about, though, and I'm not politically savvy, and I'm sure that many of you have figured this out. It just seems to me that the insurance industry is saying the cap ought to be increased, knowing that that may never happen. I wish it would happen. I hope it happens. But it's so easy to just park this bill because no one can argue that the bill is just or that the current situation is just. No one would take that position. So what's really happening, and I've been watching the testimony, is it seems to me that they're just parking this hoping that it will go away because many of the government entities are insured by private insurance companies.
Wait, what did you mean by that? The government entities are insured by...
Some government entities to cover their $200,000 tort limit by private insurance policies.
I see.
And so it comes back to the same question anyway. So the prior testimony was a little bit disingenuous in my view.
Okay. Other questions from the committee?
Well, even if they're self-insured, Madam Chair, they still are subject to the cap.
Well, yes, but I think his point was some of them were insured by the folks in this room. Okay, other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Appreciate you being available.
Thank you.
Okay. You guys are being really pokey down there.
Sorry.
Okay, we will close this work session on House Bill 2908. And
were we in work session or public hearing?
We're in public hearing.
Okay.
Did I say work session?
Yes.
I meant public hearing. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2908 and House Bill 3086. And I'm going to keep these on the agenda today and not rule out that we might do something else. So for now, I want to announce that we are going to roll over House Bill 2333A. If anybody's here for that bill, we will put that on the agenda tomorrow. And now I will open a work session on General Caldwell's bill, which is 2093. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2093 was a bill we heard last week, which concerned stays of administrative proceedings for service members. There was some talk of an amendment to deal with some child custody issues, but my understanding is that those amendments will be in a different bill that this committee will be hearing tomorrow. So what is before the committee is just the original bill, 2093A.
And the original bill, committee, as you recall, got no controversy. The only reason it was held over was General Caldwell graciously allowed it to be used as a vehicle to accommodate some other worthy policies that are going to be able to find another vehicle. So, Senator Beyer, could I get a motion from you?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2093 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2093A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, I wanted to just speak to why the amendment isn't going in this bill. We had legislative counsel come up and say that the relating clause would work, and then upon further exploration, it did not. So we found a bill, just happened to find a bill relating to child custody that will be here tomorrow. So that amendment's now being drafted, and if you recall, the amendment will protect people from losing custody. Well, it will just simply say that temporary placement with another person as a result of military deployment would not constitute in and of itself a change of circumstances in determining custody orders, so that we can make sure these military folks don't come back and find out their children have been taken from them and given custody to someone else. So we'll fix it tomorrow. Okay. And I want to thank General Caldwell for being patient with me as I worked very hard on this.
And if anybody has any questions on the underlying bill, we do have General Caldwell here. It would seem to waste his appearance here if we didn't have at least some question. Okay. Are there any objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz, would you like to carry this?
Love to.
Okay. All right. What do we have left here? Which one do you want to do? We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2708. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. ORS 30.140 prohibits clauses in construction agreements that require one party to indemnify another party for damages caused by negligence. The statute defines construction agreement to mean a written agreement for the construction, alteration, repair, improvement, or maintenance of any real estate project, but not including rental agreements. What House Bill 2708 would do is prohibit that same provision. It would amend the definition of construction agreements to include written agreements for the planning and design of a project attached to a real estate. So that would, in sum, mean that if 2708 passes, the prohibition in construction agreements against indemnifying against negligence would also apply to agreements dealing with planning and design of construction projects.
Okay, we have Marshall Koba and John Larson signed up.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I'm Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon, who represent more than 110 firms and 3,000-plus employees in the state of Oregon. Thank you for this hearing on House Bill 2708. With me today is John Larson, an attorney with the law firm of Marvin Chorzampa in Portland. And this is an important issue to the engineering community. The bill passed, just for your information, 55-0 in the House, and we appreciate this opportunity. Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Marshall. For the record, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Larson. I am an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon at the law firm of Marvin Chorzampa and Larson. I and my firm are members of an organization called the American Council of Engineering Companies, the Oregon branch, ACEC Oregon. And I'm here on behalf of ACEC Oregon and on behalf of myself to talk about this technical change to the anti-indemnity statute. You have my written testimony. I won't read them. I know time is precious. The basic gist of the change that we are in favor of in House Bill 2708 is one that would restore to the statute the design community, architects and engineers, so that they aren't forced to indemnify another party for that other party's acts of negligence or wrongdoing. 2 points about that. First of all, as a policy proposition, we think it's fair that people should bear the burden of their own acts of negligence or their own wrongdoing. As a very practical matter, the insurance policies that my clients get are limited to paying for or indemnifying our clients for our own clients' failures or acts of negligence. In other words, our clients do not have insurance coverage to cover any of the acts or omissions by another party with whom we may have entered into an ill-advised contract with. So restoring the design community to the statute is, first of all, an issue of fairness in terms of people taking care of their own problems, and it also prevents my clients and the members of the design community from being uninsured entirely when faced with a provision like this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I just noticed that 5 members of the House declared potential conflicts of interest. Mr. Koba, do you know why they all declared potential conflicts of interest when they voted on this bill?
And do we have any?
Well, that's what I'm wondering, because there's so many of them.
Senator Walker, I'm not aware of why they declared a conflict of interest.
Okay. You weren't listening to the floor debate. All right. I just find it kind of odd.
Yeah, that is a very high number.
I will say that I was watching in a different bill. There was a bill that dealt with contractors, and I guess there are a number of contractors who are also representatives, and there was a large number of conflicts declared for that bill. Mm-hmm. This one concerns construction agreements that by design professionals, but maybe there was some confusion that because they were contractors, they had to declare conflict of interest. Not just a guess, though.
I can see a couple of them, but a couple of them don't make any sense.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure we didn't need to be declaring a conflict here.
We live in mortal fear. We'll forget sometime. And
very well.
Okay.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2708 and open a work session on House Bill 2708. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2708 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2708 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, why don't you see if you can break your record for short carrying statements on this one.
It's hard to do 5 seconds.
Well, this one just makes sense, so it should be really easy for you.
It could be a good bill. It should pass then, shouldn't it? Yeah.
Okay, now we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2913. Record. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, under ERISA, benefits of a qualified plan may not be assigned or alienated. An exception exists, however, for qualified domestic relation orders, which are also known as quadros. A quadro is a domestic relations order that recognizes the existence of an alternative payee's right to receive the benefits payable from the pension plan. Under federal law, however, a domestic relations order must issue from a state court to qualify as a quadro. What House Bill 2913A would do is establish that a domestic relations order issued by a federally recognized tribal court, if filed in circuit court and in compliance with the federal law that I just described, would be considered a domestic relations order made pursuant to Oregon law for purposes of ERISA. This would apply to judgments, decrees, and orders of tribal courts that have been filed before or after the effective date of this bill, and it declares an emergency and takes effect upon passage.
Okay, we have Lewis Pitt and Michael Mason.
Louis Pitt, Jr., Director of Government Affairs and Planning, Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, also a former appellate judge for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. We're very much in favor of House Bill 2913. What it is technically is a fix to the Oregon's Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, but for us what it is the federal government had some laws that they made that did not include the Indian tribes, and so in working with House Chair McPherson is Mike Mason, our tribal lobbyist, and some other folks worked on trying to get a solution here, and that's what is represented by House Bill 2913. We have Michael Mason here that also had worked on this with a team. And we have a number of real-life cases in Warm Springs dealing with folks that are need to have this law, this solution, passed and to help us tribal court move on. So, again, I appreciate, I think, the working with the state of Oregon as we have on this to try to and through this would be coming up with a solution for our government, again, to be able to carry out the continued powers that we've had in domestic relations of our people. So, again, committee, thank you very much. If you, Michael Mason worked on some of this along the way, and I think I'll leave it at that. That, again, we're in support of this, is that we need this to, do what's fair to our tribal membership, our citizens of our nation.
Thank you. And Mr. Mason, did you want to add anything?
Chair Burdick and members of the Judiciary Committee, Michael Mason, lobbyist for the Confederated Tribes on Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. I did just want to add a thank you to Chair McPherson on the House Judiciary Committee. When I first mentioned this to him, he saw immediately the problem with the Pension Protection Act of 2006, which the Congress had passed and mysteriously had not mentioned tribes. And we have a situation of exclusive jurisdiction over these cases on the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Tribal Court. And if they can't divide the pensions, then nobody else can divide. No other court can divide them either. So it was, and there's many tribes in that situation. So it was a very odd thing that the Congress, which is passes Indian laws every year, somehow missed that. So this is, again, we're very appreciative to the chair and on the House side. And as I recall, this went on the consent calendar. So.
Well, you know, you happen to pick one of the most accomplished pension experts in the state to be your House chair this year, and certainly not my wish to meddle in his work. We have no one signed up in opposition. Are there questions from the committee?
Well, Madam Chair, just say, are you really surprised that the feds would screw something up?
Well, particularly, I mean, Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, well, I've been in the Indian law business for 23 years, and they're pretty accomplished at doing that. Yes, I'm not very surprised.
All right, with that editorial comment, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2913 and open a work session on House Bill 2913. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2913 to the floor with a defense recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2913A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Przanski, would you? No, Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. Now, committee, I held off on those other two bills and have decided that. Thank you. Decided to open a work session on House Bill 2908, which is the single subject bill on the uninsured motorist getting into a crash with a government-insured vehicle bill. The other bill has subject matter that is interesting to this committee but needs a little bit more work on the family liability side of it, but I feel pretty comfortable opening a work session on House Bill 2908, so that's what I'm going to do. Senator Przanski, would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2908 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski has moved House Bill 2908 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Good bill. It should pass.
Any objection?
Madam Chair, I would be an objection, and I guess discussion would be we did hear about Government Tort Claim Liability Act earlier, and I thought we were had worked out something on that. Apparently we didn't, because the bill is still languishing in the committee.
Yeah.
But I'll be opposed to this motion.
I certainly share your disappointment on that, Senator Beyer. We members of this committee worked very hard to try to get something done on the tort caps themselves, and the only thing I can say is if we are ultimately successful, that will make fewer claims that fall under these provisions. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Senator Walker. Aye. Vice Chair Biden?
No.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Passes. And Senator Przanski, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. That completes our agenda. And just a reminder, we'll have House Bill 2333 on our agenda again tomorrow. And we are adjourned. Thank you.